the big military base at Diego Garcia. Mm-hmm. And there are reports now suggesting that Trump's disaffection from that deal may be linked to the UK not agreeing to allow the use of British bases on any potential attack on Iran. What is your reaction to what is happening over the Chagos Islands?
Well, I think that the president has obviously stated his concern over the impermanence of the lease arrangement that was proposed by Prime Minister Starmer. And honestly, this is a national security issue for the United States. That is a very key military base for the United States. It has the ability to project power both through the presence of U.S. bombers and other assets in the region. That is something that the U.S. is very keen to keep under its control and to maintain the ability to use as it sees fit going forward. And so I'm not surprised that the president would make this determination over that.
Brett, thank you very much. Brett Schaefer there. Thank you very much for joining me on The Times at One. That is pretty much it from me for today and indeed for this week. Thanks so much for your company. Aisha Hazarika is here at 1 o'clock tomorrow. Producer today was Lizzie Highfield. Ryan Boyden was pressing the buttons. Danny Finkelstein is in this chair next week, but right now, Jane is here. She's poised. She's up next on Times Radio.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Stephen, thank you very much and good afternoon. It is 2 o'clock. You're listening to Jane Garvey on Times Radio. In the next couple of hours, there's only one story in town, really, and we've got the Sunday Times Royal Editor Roy Anika with us shortly for the latest on the arrest of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. We also have a reporter in Sandringham and we'll talk too about the legal and historical aspects of all this. Donald Trump is speaking shortly as his Board of Peace meets in Washington, just as speculation about war with Iran increases. Our very own Daryl Morris is out and about. He's in Gorton and Denton ahead of that make-or-break by-election next Thursday. And Vassos Alexander will bring us more on the crises enveloping the biggest clubs, the biggest football clubs in North London. Spurs and Arsenal both have troubles. We'll talk about them a little later. Here's the news at 2, Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. King Charles says the law must take its course after his brother, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, was arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office. The King also says he learned the news with the deepest concern and says there will be a full, fair and proper process. Andrew was held this morning on the Sandringham estate in Norfolk on his 66th birthday. The Times understands that neither he nor the King were given advance warning. Officers from Thames Valley Police say they are assessing allegations that Andrew forwarded confidential reports to Jeffrey Epstein while he was a UK trade envoy. Di Davis, a former head of Royal Protection, has told Times Radio the King needs to be investigated as well.
I'd be looking at his role and those who have been advising the King for the last number of years. That's going to have to come out, unfortunately. And if it shows that courtiers and others, police officers, you name it, those travelling, knew about some of these actions, perhaps they did, perhaps they didn't. It's an allegation, but it has to be investigated. There's no going back now.
The historian A.N. Wilson says previous generations of the royal family would have had a different experience.
If this had happened to one of Queen Victoria's sons, who were a pretty bad lot, some of them, it would have all been hushed up. There were various scandals relating to Queen Victoria's grandchildren, which were all hushed up. I mean they were mainly sex scandals, but if this sort of thing had happened, and there was a great deal of skullduggery, they wouldn't have been arrested.
Norman Baker, a former Lib Dem Home Office minister who wrote a book about the royal, says this is a dangerous moment for them.
If you look at the opinion polling that's taken place over some decades, the 86% support for the royal family in 1983, I think it was, is now down to 50%. So there's been a drip-drip effect. And, you know, my advice to Charles, and after all I'm a privy councillor, technically advising Charles, is that he needs to modernise the family and modernise the royal family's arrangements before it's done for him by Parliament and by the public.
In other news, the Times understands the UK is yet to give permission for the US to use the military base on Diego Garcia and RAF Fairford in Gloucestershire in the event that Donald Trump orders a strike on Iran. A British couple, Craig and Lindsay Foreman, have been sentenced to 10 years in prison over allegations of espionage in Iran. The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, says their sentence is completely appalling and totally unjustifiable. A man who raped a 13-year-old girl in Rotherham has been jailed for 20 years. The woman, who's now 30, confronted 45-year-old Riyath Hussain at Sheffield's Crown Court, telling him, "You didn't just steal my childhood, you stole the rest of my life." And Sir Keir Starmer has appointed Dame Antonia Romeo as Britain's first female cabinet secretary. Romeo, currently the permanent secretary of the Home Office, will replace Sir Chris Wormald, who was sacked by Starmer last week. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon, and there is only one story. It's making headlines all over the world today.
We've just had this breaking news. Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor has been arrested on suspicion of misconduct.
Thames Valley Police say that Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor has been arrested on suspicion of misconduct.
We are back with a Fox News alert. Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor, formerly known as Prince Andrew of the UK, has reportedly been arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office.
Well, who better to turn to? And we will very shortly. The Sunday Times Royal Editor Roya Nika is here. We've also got Joshua Rosenberg on the legal aspects of all this and Professor Anna Whitelock on the history of the monarchy. She'll have plenty to say as well, I'm sure. There is other stuff around. President Trump's Board of Peace meets for the first time around now. We'll talk to Katie Balls in Washington and get the thoughts of Greg Colstrom of The Economist. Darrell Morris is on the ground in Gorton and Denton. That by-election, which is make or break for Keir Starmer, some people say, is this time next week. And in the dizzy world of sport, Arsenal, are they going to throw it all away again? Are they bottlers? And could Spurs get relegated? Vassos Alexander with us at about 3:15. And after 3:30, the journalist and author Felicity Spector on Bread and War, her phenomenal book about Ukraine. We are approaching the fourth anniversary, of course, of the Russian invasion. Your thoughts are welcome. Here's a view from America already. Wow, Andrew arrested. Wish my country held these men accountable, says Sher. We should say, of course, that Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor denies all allegations of wrongdoing. But nevertheless, that is a big story. The most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. And I should say you can read all of these on thetimes.com. You will need a digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe. At number three, Trump pulls support of Keir Starmer's Chagos Islands deal. The US president suggests Britain is caving to wokeism and that America may need the Diego Garcia Air Base to strike Iran. The second most read story, trial of climber who left girlfriend to die, shakes community. This is what happened when Kirsten Gärtner was left to freeze on Austria's biggest peak. It could, we're told, rewrite the mountaineering handbook on amateur climbs. And no surprise, the most read piece on the Times website is Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor arrested for misconduct in public office. So let's go to the Sunday Times Royal Editor, Roya Nika. The former Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, says he has submitted a new 5-page memorandum to police after previously flagging information about flights by Jeffrey Epstein to UK airports. Now, this new submission comes after the arrest of Andrew on suspicion of misconduct in public office. The King has made a statement today. He says the law must take its course following his brother's arrest. Andrew has consistently denied any wrongdoing. Roya, this is quite a day, isn't it?
The word that's bandied around so much at the moment, unprecedented, this really is. I mean, this is historic. It was quite extraordinary to see the images of those cars arriving at Wood Farm, at Sandringham, which is where Andrew is temporarily staying. Obviously, he was booted out of Royal Lodge recently, because it has felt for the last few days and weeks like momentum. There was gathering momentum. There was so much discussion around the fact that various police forces had looked at this before. The Met had looked at this many times or looked at various allegations. It was always no further action, nothing to see here. You know, I think the involvement of the National Crime Agency yesterday, it just escalated. But to see the King's brother arrested and to see the King make that statement about his brother is something I never thought I would see.
In a way, what else could the king say other than we must let the law take its course?
Well, he could say nothing. I think that what the palace have said in the last few weeks is he's gone so far as he can. He's pulled all the levers. We had that statement while we were in Saudi Arabia last week, both from the king and from the Prince of Wales. I think now they will sit tight and watch and see what happens. Obviously, Andrew hasn't been charged. And, you know, in the king's statement today, he's very mindful of saying there's a process now. I can't really say any more. But really difficult for the wider family. I mean, he ends that statement saying, I'll continue to serve you. And he is out and about today opening London Fashion Week, which must be extremely uncomfortable for him.
Yeah. I can't imagine, but yes, of course it is.
Yeah.
And the royal show's staying on the road, is it?
It is always that thing, isn't it? Never complain, never explain, and business as usual. I mean, the king will feel, if I was to cancel that, I'm letting down the British fashion industry, all the designers that want to meet me, and I'm supposed to sort of be raising attention for there. But it's a very strange thing to see the king at London Fashion Week and his brother arrested.
As you say, this is unprecedented. Would they have been given any form of special treatment, do we know? And in other words, would there have been a phone call to former Prince Andrew's people at, I don't know, 7:30 this morning to say, look, the police are on their way?
I don't know about that. Andrew doesn't really have any people anymore, but I do know that the king and the palace were not given a heads up. They were not given advance notice of his arrest. And I think that is a little bit of a mood music change. I think that previously the police have probably kept the palace abreast of various developments. But I think, you know, in the way that we've all seen momentum gathering, I don't think it'll have come as a shock to the king and the palace that he has been arrested, notwithstanding the fact that he continues to deny all wrongdoing. But it is just quite an extraordinary thing to be talking about.
Do we know how Andrew will have reacted? I mean, we know he's still in custody. I have no idea what that might be like, but it won't be what he's used to.
He has been, for the last decades of his life, particularly since this story started to gather momentum back in 2010, protected. He's been protected by lawyers. He's been protected by settlements. He's been protected by gagging orders against, you know, Virginia Giuffre, who sadly, you know, took her own life last year. So nothing really came out for a very long time. He has been able to hide behind palace walls. Even though the king and the royal family tried to distance him, he has had that protection. This arrest shows, as the DPP said, and as Keir Starmer said this morning, nobody is above the law, not even the royals, and he no longer has that protection.
It is also his birthday. I mean, it's insignificant, but it's worth noting.
It's just an extraordinary fact in an extraordinary set of circumstances. I'm sure that's not the way he thought he'd be celebrating his birthday.
Properties are being searched, we're told. Which properties?
The police haven't made an actual formal statement on that. I don't think they have. I think it would be fair to assume that Wood Farm is probably being searched. We saw 8 cars arriving there this morning. Possibly Royal Lodge. I mean, a lot of stuff was moved from Royal Lodge when he went up to Norfolk, but there'll be a lot of documentation still there. We don't know whether the private offices at Buckingham Palace are being searched. I mean, Andrew hasn't technically had an office there since 2019. But there will be so many more questions now for the wider royal household in terms of who knew what when.
Well, yes, I mean, he had people working very closely for him, with him, the police protection officers, yes, but other administrative staff, private secretaries and so on.
He did. He had private secretaries. He had a whole host of staff in his private office until that disastrous Newsnight interview where the Queen basically said, you know, step back, and he was booted out of Buckingham Palace and his private office was disbanded. But for many years, and for that entire decade as trade envoy, which is what the police specifically are looking at now, for that decade as the UK's trade envoy, and it is extraordinary to think that the government at the time thought that was a good idea, we can talk more about that another time, there will be private secretaries, there will be aides, there will be assistants, there are the PPOs, all of whom were travelling the world with him, on the end of emails, you know, abreast of a lot of what he was doing. And there will be some serious questions to be asked and to be answered by a lot of those people.
Well, there is the possibility, isn't there, that some of those people, I'm thinking particularly of relatively low-paid public servants who will have been instructed, I'm guessing, to turn a blind eye. That's not their fault, is it?
No, of course it's not their fault. It's a tricky one, isn't it? You work for a prince. A prince who's very demanding, a prince who will have very clear views on what he thought he could do. And you know, for years, the royal households have been not always entirely transparent, quite hard to sort of access. But I think there'll be a lot of questions to be asked and a lot of doors being knocked on in the next few days and months.
We have got a question here from a listener, Roya. Is it possible that the fallout from all this could force the abdication of the king?
No, I don't think that's going to happen. Why would the king abdicate? There is a crisis in the monarchy at the moment. There are huge questions to ask, but I don't think, as things stand, you know, and Charles always made it very clear, even at the time, he didn't think Andrew should become the trade envoy. It was something that the late queen wanted.
Right. How do we know that the king, the current king, was so anti the appointment?
Because he's let it be known. It's been widely reported and has never been challenged in books, in newspaper reports, in broadcast. When the king wants something to be known, it gets out there.
Right. OK.
No, I don't think he's going to abdicate.
OK. No. Well, people are asking.
Yeah.
I guess it's
fair question.
Not surprising. The number, by the way, is 0333 003 2353. So we know the king is out and about. So, too, I think, is the queen. She's also gone somewhere else today. I don't know. Perhaps they're at the same thing. I don't know.
He's opening London Fashion Week. I believe the queen is doing something, some sort of musical engagement later on today. Business as usual, but a very strange time to be doing it.
Yeah. He can be held for quite some time, can't he, Andrew?
I'm
before
not
for being charged. We're going to talk, I should say, to Joshua Rosenberg.
Yeah,
a bit later.
Yeah, I don't know what the time limit on that is, but we do know. I mean, what the police did say this morning was he's still being held in custody, and we haven't had a change on that yet. So, the fact that the king's brother is being held in custody, just it's just an extraordinary thing to think about in terms of how things have gone,
and could spend the night in a police cell.
He could spend the night in a police cell.
Thank you, Roya. I'm sure that people are more than interested in this story, and you're doing a podcast later on, aren't you?
We're doing a special episode of the Royals podcast, which will be out later today. Yeah.
Okay, you can find that wherever you get your podcast from. It's always a good listen. Thank you very much indeed. That is Roya Nika, the Sunday Times Royal Editor. You are listening to Times Radio, and we do welcome, obviously, your involvement every day, but today you may well have points to get across, questions to ask. Feel free to do so. 0333 003 2353. Next, we're going to head across the Atlantic to find out what's been happening as world leaders gather for the first meeting of Donald Trump's Board of Peace. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio with Wickes. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Explore all the sale offers at wickes.co.uk or visit your local Wickes store.
The State of It USA is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times that brings you real truth about US politics and power. Join political heavyweights Katie Balls and Gerard Baker as they take a deep dive into the latest wrangles in the White House and bring you intelligent analysis and insight.
I went out on the road this week with the First Lady and we rode back in the motorcade.
No fake news, no flag waving and no Trump derangement syndrome. Just the inside track on the decisions that are shaping America. The State of It USA is available now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. That's why it's no surprise that more than 85% of the Fortune 500 use the ServiceNow AI platform. While other platforms duct tape tools together, ServiceNow seamlessly unifies people, data, workflows, and AI, connecting every corner of your business. And with AI agents working together autonomously, anyone in any department can focus on the work that matters most. Learn how ServiceNow puts AI to work for people at servicenow.co.uk.
It's your last chance to save with final reductions in the biggest Furniture Village sale of the year. But hurry, many offers end this Sunday.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes. Right now, the kitchen and bathroom sale is on. There are options to suit every budget and every home. Browse all the kitchen and bathroom sale offers at wickes.co.uk.
Thanks for your questions and comments so far. James says, the royal family desperately needs to justify itself financially. This pompous, never complain, never explain nonsense won't do, especially in hard economic times. If the royal family can prove it's a net contributor to tourism, it should be nurtured as now. If not, then I think we should think about an alternative for them and for us. Yes. Okay. There's a great article, by the way, on thetimes.com now. In fact, it's relatively fresh to thetimes.com by Peter Chappell. Which other royals have been arrested throughout history? It's just worth saying that the last time a member of the royal family was arrested was, what do you think? It's a good one to tickle your intellectual taste buds this afternoon. Well, it was more than 350 years ago. It was Charles I, and he was taken prisoner by parliamentary forces. Different set of circumstances, but it's that long ago that it happened. Now, you must be wondering, because it's Thursday and with so much going on, will there be Proud as a Peacock? Yes, there will. We're sticking with the Wix Proud as a Peacock competition. Now, we'd like to know your proudest moments of the week, so you could be in with a chance to win a Wix voucher, 250 quid's worth of a Wix voucher in our Wix Peacock Awards. So the WhatsApp is 0333 003 2353, or you can email janeofee@times.radio and I'll announce the winner at the end of the show. Don't forget the Wix kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Just worth saying, some have come in already. Kyra tries every week and she's tried again, and I promise you're in the pile, Kyra. Thank you. Sharon says, I'm so proud as a peacock of my 34 years contribution to education and making a difference to countless lives. Bigging themselves up, but frankly, why not? And Diane says, I'm proud of my wonderful husband, Laurie, who's worked hard throughout his life and conquered many difficulties along the way and has shown tremendous kindness to so many people and adored me, his wife, his daughters and his grandchildren. I'm proud of him every day, says Diane. You're in the pile as well. Thank you all, and you can still enter. There is time. The Wix kitchen and bathroom sale's now on. Explore all the sales offers at wix.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wix store. Now, it's not just news regarding the royal family and Andrew today. Other stuff, incredibly, is going on. Notably, the world leaders who are gathering in Washington for the inaugural meeting of Donald Trump's Board of Peace. It comes amid growing speculation that the US president will actually choose around this time to order an attack on Iran. Now, The Times is reporting that the UK has refused to allow the use of British bases for any US strike. It's thought to have caused Trump to withdraw his support from Sir Keir Starmer's deal to hand the Chagos Islands to Mauritius. Katie Balls is The Times Washington editor. Katie, good afternoon from us. This probably does explain the most recent report in The Times, that change of heart on this Chagos Islands deal from Donald Trump.
Yes, I think what we have had for a long time, though, is two different narratives around the Chagos Islands deal, where you've had UK government officials for a long time saying it had US backing, it initially had Biden administration backing. They worked very hard to get some Trump administration backing. Trump spoke positively enough about the deal. But yet you'd always hear from opposition politicians in the UK, the administration are very uncomfortable about the deal. So I think it's been quite a complicated picture for some time, where on certain days, depending who you speak to, they thought, we'll help the UK government out, we can see why they've done this, it's complicated. And on other days, the president has been less than happy. And of course, when there have been strains in terms of what the US wants from the UK and other things, so Greenland was the last time Trump went very publicly against the Chagos Islands deal, when he didn't like that the UK was criticising him. And then, of course, as The Times is now reporting, this idea of not being allowed to use RAF bases around Iran, again, is a strain on the US-UK relationship, which means he's more likely to lash out on something where there's the whole time intensive lobbying from various sides to try and get the White House to criticise the deal.
Well, we'll talk about the meeting of the Board of Peace in a moment, but is there any recent development on the possibility of conflict between the USA and Iran?
Well, it definitely feels as though with every hour, the pressure is rising here. You now have the greatest gathering in terms of military, US military, Navy and so forth around in the region since 2003. And that all suggests that the president is really thinking about taking action. And when these decisions get delayed, if you think back to when there were the protests just a couple of weeks ago and Donald Trump said, help is coming, when he did that, you had a situation where lots of people thought he was about to move and then he decided not to. But that doesn't mean it's not going to happen. And I think there is a feeling that it could be as soon as this weekend. However, we also know that part of what Donald Trump is trying to do is apply maximum pressure to force the Iranians to come and offer the compromise, the deal that he wants when it comes to, obviously, nuclear.
Right. It is a bit odd, isn't it, to have this big grandstanding event, the Board of Peace meeting, whilst at the same time conflict with Iran appears to draw ever closer?
Well, many have pointed this out, which is the Board of Peace at the time when you're thinking about striking Iran, of course, what they would say is peace through strength. That would be the line from the administration. And the question is, how does Donald Trump go about achieving his foreign policy objectives? What do other countries think about striking Iran? Certainly in America, I think that it would be complicated domestically on opinion. But you have lots of people saying, oh, regime change is the best thing for the world. It would be incredibly complicated. It would potentially be a very messy conflict that would go on for a long time to come. And I think the question is there something on targeted strikes against Trump, what he wants, or is he entering something that would really define and dominate the rest of his presidency, which is why I think there are a lot more nerves around this than, say, Venezuela, when he, you know, kickstarted the year by going in, taking Nicolas Maduro. Venezuela, you speak to figures in the administration, they would make the point that Venezuela is, you know, much smaller, much simpler in a way to even put in, say, the leader is not empowered, but Maduro is number two, and get them to enact your will. How do you do that when it comes to the Ayatollah? So I think this is a very complicated situation, but it does feel that it is moving in a way where the chance of military action is increasing.
And Katie, just briefly, back to the big, big news story of the day about Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor's arrest. I appreciate it's relatively early in Washington, but is there any chatter there about the fact that at least something appears to be happening in the UK?
Yeah, I think, as you say, the day is just beginning in Washington, D.C. But I think that there has been a sense in recent weeks that the UK seems to take more seriously action against those in the Epstein files than the US does. Now, there have been lots of US businessmen and figures who have, you know, stepped down from boards, taken, almost removed themselves from public life. When it comes to some of those prominent names in the files, obviously the president himself has faced many questions, but particularly those in the latest tranche who are found to have spent time with the financier in ways that they clearly weren't truthful with. So Howard Lutnick, the Commerce Secretary, you know, what has been the consequence of that? And I think you speak to particularly Democrats, but some Republicans, who think that there is a sense in the UK that the law is, you know, equal and being applied to everyone, particularly, I think, now with the fact a member of the royal family has, you know, been arrested. In a way that I don't think there is a sense of here in the US. You have Pam Bondi, the Attorney General. I mean, of course, it is because of the US that these files are out there, because Congress forced the White House's hand, and that's why it's there. But you don't get a sense that the priority of the DOJ right now is trying to prosecute certain figures in the files. Almost the files are out there, and they say that is job done on transparency.
Interesting. Thank you very much indeed, Katie. I appreciate your time. That's Katie Balls, The Times Washington editor. Let's get a view now about the Middle East and the relationship to the Board of Peace meeting today with the economist Greg Colstrom. That's Greg Colstrom of The Economist. He's not an economist. Greg, good afternoon from us. How are you?
Good afternoon to you. I'm good, thanks.
Tell us then about who's at this meeting today.
The largest contingent, I would say, comes from countries in the region. You have a lot of Arab countries, those in the Gulf, for example, like Saudi Arabia and the UAE, that have agreed to join this board. I think not so much out of enthusiasm about the idea of the board or what it's trying to do, but worry about what Trump is doing or not doing with regards to the ceasefire in Gaza. And they feel like they need to have a seat at the table in order to be involved in that. So they are there. A number of Asian countries are there. You have some states, the likes of, you know, Azerbaijan and Pakistan, which don't really have anything to do with Gaza, but want to curry favor with Donald Trump. And then you have a handful of countries in Europe that have either joined, like Viktor Orban's Hungary, or have not joined the board but are sending representatives like Italy. But by and large, America's Western allies staying away from this. It's more of a regional representation, I would say.
And the notion of all this grew out of what to do about Gaza. What is happening on the ground there? Because Hamas have yet to be disarmed. Israeli forces are still on the ground. What's happening?
Very little has changed, I would say, since October, when the ceasefire took hold. As you say, the board is meant to be one of several entities that are overseeing the ceasefire and also the future of Gaza. So there's meant to be an executive committee, which is headed by a former UN official that will oversee governance on the ground. There's what's being called a technocratic government of Palestinians, that's being stood up to provide services in Gaza. You know, it all sounds good on paper, but in reality, as you say, Israeli troops are still occupying about 50% of Gazan territory. Hamas has retaken control of the other half. They refuse to disarm. And there's still been no real progress towards what's known as the International Stabilization Force, which is meant to be a peacekeeping force that, according to the ceasefire, is going to go into Gaza and attempt to disarm Hamas. Now, there may be an announcement today at this Board of Peace meeting related to peacekeepers. Some people in Washington have said to look out for that today. But I think even if there is an announcement, even if Trump says, you know, there's a few countries that are willing to join, we still don't know exactly how many troops are being sent, what their mandate is going to be. We're still a long way from, I think, having a viable peacekeeping force that can do the very difficult work of disarming Hamas and trying to secure Gaza.
Yeah, and there is no Palestinian representation on the Board of Peace.
No, there's not. And if you look at the entirety of this edifice that has been set up for post-war governance in Gaza, the role of the Palestinians is quite limited. They are meant to be only representatives on this so-called technocratic government, which handles day-to-day administration in Gaza. That government has been announced. A number of Palestinians have been appointed to it, but it's not clear so far if they're going to have any money, if they're going to have any resources, if Israel is even going to allow them to physically enter the Gaza Strip. And so decisions about what happens going forward, they're really being made outside of Gaza and by non-Palestinians.
And the possibility now looks like the very real possibility of an American attack on Iran. Who will be saying what about that today?
Everyone in the region is frantically trying to stop it from happening. I don't think they're going to be very successful. Countries in the Gulf in particular are worried that they are going to be targeted in any Iranian retaliation. If America attacks Iran, Iran obviously can't strike back at America directly, and so it might lash out at American bases in countries like Qatar and Bahrain in the Persian Gulf. It might strike at their cities or at their oil infrastructure as well. And so everyone is extremely nervous about that. They have tried to dissuade Trump from carrying out strikes. They have made it clear to the Iranians that they're not going to allow their territory or their airspace to be used in any American military campaign. This, you know, they were worried last summer before Trump carried out strikes on Iran's nuclear facilities, and they're even more concerned now because it seems as if whatever America is building up towards here, it's going to be much bigger than what we saw last summer. It's not just going to be a one-off strike against a few nuclear sites.
Greg Kahlstrom of The Economist, thank you very much for that. You're listening to Times Radio. It is just after 2:30 now. And in the next half an hour, we are going to have a reporter at Sandringham. Ollie Cole has made his way there. We're also talking about the legal ramifications with Joshua Rosenberg. That's next. After the headlines on Times Radio, Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. King Charles says the law must take its course after his brother, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, was arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office relating to his time as a UK trade envoy. Andrew was held this morning on the Sandringham estate in Norfolk on his 66th birthday. The Times understands that neither he nor the King were given advance warning. The Sunday Times' royal editor, Roy Anika, says it's unprecedented.
This is historic. It was quite extraordinary to see the images of those cars arriving at Wood Farm at Sandringham, which is where Andrew is temporarily staying. Obviously, he was booted out of Royal Lodge recently, because it has felt for the last few days and weeks like momentum. There was gathering momentum. There was so much discussion around the fact that various police forces had looked at this before. But to see the King's brother arrested and to see the King make that statement about his brother is something I never thought I would see.
Andrew has always denied any wrongdoing. In other news, the Times understands the UK is yet to give permission for the US to use the military base on Diego Garcia and RAF Fairford in Gloucestershire in the event that Donald Trump orders a strike on Iran. And Keir Starmer has appointed Dame Antonia Romeo as Britain's first female cabinet secretary. Romeo, currently the permanent secretary of the Home Office, will replace Sir Chris Wormald, who was sacked by Starmer last week. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
The Philly cheese stack is back at McDonald's and it's still intensely cheesy. Imagine the cheesiest thing ever. Now cover it in cheese. Add two beef patties, cheddar cheese sauce, crispy onions, and even more cheese. The Philly cheese stack. Did we mention it's cheesy? Available until the 16th of March 2026 from 11 a.m. Fees apply to delivery orders. Price and participation may vary, subject to availability.
Donations to British Heart Foundation fund scientific research that can help save lives. People like Joe, who's pitching his next big business plan. Maria, who's sending out her wedding invitations. And Jack, who's just being a teenager again. Because when you donate, you fund more than just science. You help save lives. British Heart Foundation funds research that aims to cure inherited heart muscle diseases. But our work is not done. Donate now at bhf.org.uk and keep us beating.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes. Ready to start planning your new kitchen or bathroom? If you'd like a personalised design, the Wix free design service can guide you through the whole process, including a free home measure. Book today at wix.co.uk.
Yes, it's Proud as a Peacock, Wix Thursday here on Times Radio. The prize, and who wouldn't want this, 250 quid's worth of Wix voucher could wing its way to you if you are the winner. And as Fee's not here, I get to select the winner myself, so it's giving me a tremendous amount of power, which I'm thoroughly enjoying. Let's just briefly bring in Sarah, who says, this week, I'm feeling proud of my parents for painting our living room themselves. I must say they've done an incredibly good job. They are both 66 and they like to stay active with various activities like gardening and DIY. And this was their first attempt at painting and they didn't argue much. It was a win-win. Well done them, and they're certainly going in my possible pile. Thank you very much for that. 66, and they can still do a bit of decorating. Seb Payne, who's, you must only be in your 20s, Seb.
That's very kind of you, but I think 30s is putting it
all right.
More wisely.
Okay. Well, you're with us on Times Radio between 4 and 7 tonight. What are you talking about?
That's right. I'm sitting in for John Pienaar, who's having a well-deserved evening off, and we'll be looking at some of the huge stories we've been having today, starting off, of course, with the arrest of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. And we're going to be joined by royal historian Professor Kate Williams to delve into just how a unique moment this is. You know, you have to go back hundreds of years to find anything similar. And we're also going to have the Conservative grandee, Sir Jacob Rees-Mogg, joining us.
He's practically royalty himself, isn't he?
He's practically royalty. He's not made it to the House of Lords just yet. Of course, his father was, though, former editor of the Times. So he'll be giving us his historical perspective on that and the other stories. We'll also be looking at the first female cabinet secretary, Antonia Romeo, who was appointed by the Prime Minister this morning. And her right at the top of the civil service has been a little controversial, I would say. So we're speaking to some constitutional experts about what's been going on there. And if that's not enough for you as well, we're also looking at the military chiefs warning the Prime Minister about the possible war if defence spending is not increased, likening it to a 1930s moment. And we'll have Lord Dannett, who will be joining us, to take us through all that area.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Seb. Seb Payne with us here live on Times Radio between 4 o'clock and 7. And then Kate Borsay takes over. And I think she's got a good guest tonight. It's the novelist Lionel Shriver talking to Kate a little bit later. Times Radio, this is Jane Garvey. And the big story of the day is that Andrew Mountbatten Windsor has been arrested. He is in police custody on suspicion of misconduct in public office. And we're told that police officers are searching addresses in Norfolk and in Berkshire. Now, Times Radio's reporter Ollie Cole can join us from the Royal Estate at Sandringham, where Andrew now spends his time. Ollie, good afternoon. What do we know about what happened there this morning?
Good afternoon. Yes, we're at Wood Farm here on the Sandringham Estate, where Andrew, formerly Prince Andrew, was spending time and residing before moving to his new lodges, courtesy of the King. And it was a sort of rude awakening, really. Today is Andrew Mountbatten Windsor's 66th birthday. And at 8 this morning, approximately, a group of unmarked cars arrived here on the estate. And just before 10 a.m, we got confirmation from Thames Valley Police confirming the arrest of a man in his 60s on suspicion of misconduct in public office. Now, it is usual police protocol not to name that person, but obviously that person we understand to be Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. So searches are going on behind us here. We've seen sort of flurries of cars going in and out throughout the morning and into the afternoon, also at his residence, former residence in Windsor, and they'll be searching throughout the day. Meanwhile, Andrew himself was taken away and brought to police custody by Thames Valley Police. We don't currently know where he is in custody, but it's possible that wherever it is will now not take any further detainees for the rest of the day, given his high profile. And police will have 24 hours to question him and then make a decision as to whether to release him or charge him. They can, of course, look for more time if they want to. They can apply to senior officers and magistrates to get a maximum of 96 hours to question him. But at the moment, what's happening here is a flurry of media activity, but also a flurry of police activity, where it's been all through the morning now, police searching through the estate. And of course, we'll be searching not just through what we know and has been released in those Department of Justice Epstein files, but also other materials that Andrew may be holding at his residences related to their investigation.
Right. I would imagine, Ollie, that you have been joined there by media from, well, you tell me, all over the world.
Yes, indeed. It's been a sort of descending on Sandringham moment. It's sort of grey and drizzly, so it's not the sort of happiest place to be at the moment. But, you know, this is a huge story. I don't think we can sort of play that down in any way. I mean, you know, the King has intervened himself to say that, you know, justice must now take its course and that he's now aware. We don't think that the King or the Palace were aware that the arrest was going to take place until it happened this morning. And from those early pictures, I mean, we had a few photographs. So there's just a churchyard nearby where those photographs were taken of those cars arriving on the estate. That's when we got the first inkling, really, that something was going on here this morning on Andrew's 66th birthday. And from that moment onwards, it took sort of just a couple of hours for news to emerge that an arrest had in fact taken place. That was then confirmed. And now around me, there are photographers from news agencies around the world. There are camera crews everywhere, and there are police vehicles and police officers lining the streets just outside of Andrew's home here in Sandringham. So it is a busy place, and obviously somewhere down the road in a custody suite, Andrew himself is now being questioned by police.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that, Ollie. Times Radio's reporter Ollie Cole, live in Sandringham. So let's talk to Joshua Rosenberg, solicitor and legal affairs commentator. Good afternoon, Joshua. Hello, Joshua.
Yeah, can you hear me? Good afternoon.
It's all good. Thank you very much. I can indeed. Yeah. So I think unprecedented is probably the word of the day, isn't it? What would you say about that?
Certainly is. There was an incident more than 20 years ago when the Princess Royal was charged with, I think, allowing her dogs to roam free. So the royal family are not above the law, something which I think politicians and indeed the King has been emphasising today. But we've not seen a member of the royal family arrested, having his homes searched, that sort of thing, in modern times. It's pretty shocking.
It is, actually, if we're honest, it's shocking. Can you just take us behind that allegation of misconduct in public office? Now, what actually does that mean, Joshua?
This is what we call a common law offence. In other words, one that has been developed by the courts over the centuries, in fact. That has two consequences. First of all, there's no maximum penalty. The maximum you could get would be life imprisonment. And secondly, it's a bit vague and perhaps a little bit difficult to prove, although I put that point at a briefing to the Director of Public Prosecutions a week or so ago, and he said the law's pretty clear. And that's because 20 years ago, a court laid down principles distilled from previous cases. And what the offence amounts to is you have to have a public officer It's not clear what that is. It could be an MP, it could be a minister. Often it could be police officers and prison officers, but it could be anybody working as a public officer who is acting as such in that position, who willfully neglects to perform his duty or willfully misconducts himself to such a degree as to amount to an abuse of the public's trust in the office holder without reasonable excuse or justification. Now, that's quite a mouthful. Mm-hmm. The real question is whether the police can prove that Andrew Mountbatten Windsor willfully misconducted himself, presumably in his role as trade envoy, to such a degree as to amount to an abuse of the public's trust in him.
I see. Now, it has already cropped up, but I wonder if you could just tell people, because people are coming to Times Radio all the time, exactly what the law says about how long somebody can be held for.
Yes. You normally are not held for more than 24 hours. I wouldn't have thought he would be held any longer than this evening, because the police will be talking to him, and the question is he going to say anything? Now, it's only speculation, obviously, but I would be surprised if he said very much at all. I can't imagine him going into any details. He would have his lawyer with him. The lawyer would advise him not to say very much, if anything at all. So at some point, the police will come to the conclusion that there is nothing more to be gained from interviewing him at this point. Also, perhaps they will have decided that there's nothing more to be gained by a search of the property he was living in Norfolk for the past couple of weeks. So presumably he could safely go back there without any disruption to the police searches. So I wouldn't have thought he's going to be kept beyond the evening. He can be kept for more than 24 hours, and indeed the courts can authorise a longer detention. But that doesn't seem to be very likely in a case like this.
But most of us have not, fortunately for us, been arrested. What happens to someone who's arrested? Are your possessions, all your personal possessions, taken away from you?
Not necessarily. Certainly, one of the reasons for arresting somebody is in order to search them. Well, they're not likely to have any. Somebody like him is not likely to have anything on him that's going to incriminate him. But certainly, search his home, his property, his computers, his files, his papers, his documents. Again, not very likely that he's going to have anything with him in Norfolk if he moved there rather suddenly a couple of weeks ago. So I'm not sure that's going to get the police very far. Possibly more in where he used to live in Windsor. But really, I think any evidence in this case is going to come from official sources, from government sources. We heard that Gordon Brown had made various representations to various police forces a few weeks ago, the former Prime Minister. And obviously, if he is being investigated in connection with his role as a trade envoy, then government departments will have records of where he went, who he spoke to, what he said, emails he may have sent, that sort of thing. And that's the sort of thing that the police are going to look at. That's going to take weeks, months, I would have thought. And in the meantime, I would expect him to be released on bail.
Right, that is your hunch, that he will be let out at some point today?
I would have thought so. I can't see any particular point in making him spend the night in a police cell. That would just be humiliating him for no obvious purpose, unless there was some operational reason. I mean, this can happen, you know, if you arrest several people who are connected in a conspiracy and you want to stop them talking to each other before they've all been spoken to. But I don't think anything like that applies here. So I would have thought that after an interview with the police, he would be free to return on bail.
Right. Now, we know that in this instance he has been arrested in connection with one offence. We should, of course, make clear that he denies any wrongdoing. But if he were to be linked to other offences, would he need to be rearrested?
I don't think so, no, because I imagine that the police would be searching for any evidence that could be used against him of any crime. Again, I can't imagine that's very likely in terms of what they may find at his homes. But nevertheless, they can search for that. The question ultimately is whether he's going to be charged or not. That's when we know whether he's going to face criminal proceedings, or whether they're going to say, well, we've investigated, we haven't got any evidence, and that's the end of it. And at that point, They might bring charges of misconduct in public office, which is what he's being investigated for. It's conceivable if they find other evidence, then he could be charged with that. That may be at a separate time, maybe sooner, maybe later. So it's really the charge point where when one knows what allegations he's facing.
OK, and can I just put this question to you from a listener called Chris, who says, in general, how does the law view people who are aware of criminal activity within their circle but do nothing to report it?
I don't think there's a general obligation on individuals to report crimes, allegations of crimes by other people. Now, there are quite recently some new failure to prevent offences relating to bribery, corruption offences, things like that. But generally speaking, it's not an obligation on people who know about an offence to report it to the police, although you might say that a good citizen would do just that.
OK, thank you very much. Much appreciate your expertise, Joshua. Joshua Rosenberg, solicitor, legal affairs commentator, Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor, denies any wrongdoing. Now, Donald Trump is delivering a speech at the inaugural meeting of his Board of Peace. World leaders, well, some of them, have gathered for the event in Washington. Let's just have a quick listen to what the US president's been saying.
What we're doing is very simple. Peace. It's called the Board of Peace, and it's all about an easy word to say, but a hard word to produce, peace. But we're going to produce it, and we've been doing a really good job. And some of these leaders that are with us have helped me very much during just this first year. We have a first year like probably no other ever in our country, because we settled 8 wars and I think a 9th to come. It's turned out to be a tougher one. I thought that was going to be the easiest one. But with war, you never know what's easy and what's not so easy. But we've had a great relationship, and I've become friendly with so many of the people. And I appreciate you being here. These are great people. These are great leaders. And the people that are watching by closed circuit and open circuit in many cases are so proud of it. They want it to be open. But they become incredible friends of mine. And
he's off on one of his rambles, isn't he? That's President Donald J. Trump talking about his Board of Peace. There will be more on that throughout the evening here on Times Radio. Now, we're going to keep bringing you the latest news on the arrest of Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor, but imminently it's Jane Mulkerins who's peeking inside this weekend's Times magazine. It is now 10 to 3. It's Jane Garvey on Times Radio with Wicks, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Times Radio Breakfast with Visit Scotland. Discover Times Radio's essential weekend briefing, where intelligent conversation meets incisive analysis of all the big stories making the headlines. Exploring the wider news agenda with guests from across politics, business, the arts and more. Times Radio Breakfast, Saturday and Sunday mornings from 6 with Visit Scotland. Start your story in Scotland with visitscotland.com/winter.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
With up to £3,000 every year towards career growth at Amazon, I started in the warehouse knowing I could train in things like coding or robotics. It turns my job into a career. So it means I can be who I want to be, even if I haven't quite decided who that is yet.
Amazon. Opening doors with up to £3,000 every year towards career growth. Eligibility conditions about type and duration of employment apply.
This is Times Radio.
Jane Mulkerins is here, associate editor at the Times magazine. It's just, can we just honour the fact, it's just been a busy old day, hasn't it?
And it really has, Jane.
Can we just say, heightened atmosphere in the building, I've noticed today.
There's a buzz about the place, isn't there?
There really is. Mm. But we weren't to know it was going to happen today. Although,
I think, you know, when Keir Starmer said the thing he said this morning, I did think, oh, that's interesting. Head above the parapet.
Right.
You know, I did think,
Okay.
Mystic Mulkerins there.
No, I'm the mystic one. Right, don't try and take that away from me. Now, the magazine is always a cracking read, but this week I do think it's excellent, I have to say.
Thanks very much.
Now, who has Alice Thompson been to interview? Because I think a lot of people would be very interested in this.
Yeah, Alice Thompson has been to Spain to interview Miriam González Durantes, who, if you couldn't remember, is Nick Clegg's wife.
But that's not how she sees herself.
That is not how she sees herself.
Let's just be honest.
Quite rightly.
Quite right.
So, I mean, we were just talking about how much we like our jobs, Jane, and I do really like my job, but I think if my husband was worth £100 million, I'm not sure I'd bother. I don't know. But anyway, fair play to Miriam Gonzalez Durante, whose husband is worth 100 million quid thanks to those shares in Facebook. She not only has always continued to work in her very high-flying law job, but now she's started a political movement in Spain as well. I actually really didn't know the extent of, until I read this interview, the extent of corruption in Spain in their politics right now. An awful lot of scandals that we just don't see. I mean, as Miriam says quite rightly, the Brits love going on holiday to Spain, but don't really engage with it politically.
I thought that was really interesting. Mm. Most people probably in Britain wouldn't have a clue who the Spanish Prime Minister was.
No?
And I'm afraid I think a lot of people would have no idea that democracy in Spain...
Quite new.
Relatively new. Yes. Anyway, press on.
Yeah, but she... it's really interesting because she talks in the interview about how much she really didn't enjoy being a political spouse and that she found it, the scrutiny, really intense. You know, people sort of trying to ask what she was wearing when she was just trying to do the school run or, you know, get to the office, get to Brussels to do her big job. But interestingly, she thinks there's not enough scrutiny in Spain. She thinks that actually it could do with an awful lot more scrutiny because she just thinks that it's, you know... It's a dirty old business over there. So she really wants to clean up Spanish politics with her movement.
Does she? She wants to be a politician.
Well, so at the moment, it's just a movement. She hasn't actually said she would like to stand. And at the moment, it's not formally a party. It's just a movement. Mm. But it could potentially turn into a party.
So is she living in Spain?
She's commuting.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I find Brighton tough enough, but Spain might be a challenge.
She probably goes business class.
Probably. She's probably not on the Thames Link, is she? But it is interesting that their family home is still in London. They've moved back from America, but she's sort of commuting to Spain. But there's also really interesting stuff in this interview about their time in the United States, which I was fascinated by. So when Nick Clegg lost his seat and their son had been diagnosed with cancer and they wanted to have a change and go somewhere, you know, they felt a bit more positive. So they moved to California, and it just sounds, I mean, a lot of it resonated with me. New York is different, but, she was talking about the sort of, they need to invite lots of people to a party and try to make new friends and everyone would leave at six, at six and leave at eight.
You've lived in the States. Is it really like that?
California is very much like that. Yeah.
Really?
California is a very early dinner, early bed kind of place. Particularly Silicon Valley. People will meet for drinks at five, be gone by seven.
And when you say meet for drinks?
Oh, they'll have one small glass of wine, perhaps two.
Okay.
But they all drive as well, so, you know. Oh, not now, because they've all got Waygo. They've all got those driverless cars. Anyway, but she talks about sort of it being so culturally different, and that really resonated with you. And she talks about how people expect when they go there, because the language is the same, that it's going to feel like Britain, and it's particularly California is nothing like Britain.
Well, she also makes the point that however forward-facing Silicon Valley might like to think of itself, there is a misogynist constant.
Absolutely. She said there were dinners where only men would speak. But she also does say that she doesn't feel that she'd have been able to make this move into politics without America. She says she really, one of the things she embraced there and really absorbed was that it's okay to fail, that failure is a kind of step on the road to success. And that in the UK and Europe, we don't really embrace that kind of up and down roller coaster of success and failure.
Yeah.
But in the US, she feels like they're very... You know, they're very used to it being part of their journey and their story. And she's really sort of taken that to heart.
Right. OK, it's a fascinating interview. And she comes across actually as a very likeable woman who, and although you mentioned the huge amounts of money they have, she genuinely doesn't appear to be all that motivated by money. It's not her biggest thing.
No. It's very easy to say, isn't it, when you've got $100 million in the bank?
Of course it is. But she does come across well.
She does come across very well. And as a force to be reckoned with as well.
Yeah. Well done, her. Right, let's talk about this incredible school.
Oh, gosh, it really is incredible, isn't it, Jane? So listeners might have read the story last month about the London Academy of Excellence, which is a sixth form college in Newham in East London, where 62 pupils out of about 250, all from disadvantaged backgrounds, have all had offers from Oxford and Cambridge. Ben Machell's gone along to meet the pupils and the staff, and it really is an extraordinary place. I mean, they've got similar numbers of pupils being accepted to Oxbridge as St Paul's, whereas St Paul's costs nearly £40,000 a year. And the London Academy of Excellence is one of those free schools. So the free schools that were set up after Michael Gove's time as Education Secretary. The idea is that it's sort of out of the bounds of local authority control, so they can set their own curriculum and their own funding. So they've got private funding, they've got funding from other private schools.
But you don't pay.
No, okay. Absolutely. And this school proactively targets children from disadvantaged backgrounds, and like quite severely disadvantaged backgrounds. Well, a lot of homelessness.
Yeah, the head teacher, I think, is quoted as saying that we've got high levels of homelessness. We've got students moved into hotels during A-levels, parents who just leave their children for months on end. One recent student was the primary carer for their terminally ill father and had a violent brother with addiction issues. There's a lot going on in these children's
lives. So much going on. And, you know, you think about how we talk about how hard it is to get teenagers to revise and to study for their A-levels. You know, with all the benefits of home, someone doing their washing and encouraging them to sit down after a dinner that's been made for them. It's hard to imagine what these kids, what their lives look like and how they manage to focus on their studies and do so well. I mean, I do really think it's an extraordinary place. And this headmaster, Crossman, who sounds like a brilliant man, you know, he says what's interesting about it is that the school's still treated like a bit of a curiosity, that it's this sort of exception to the rule rather than what many schools could become. And he actually says, you know, why does it have to be a one-off? Why can't we have schools like this up and down the country in lots of different areas? And I do think it's true, but obviously you need the will and you need the funding from, they've got funding from HSBC, they've got funding from Eton, they've got funding from other private schools, you know, who have charitable status, obviously, to, you know, to fund it. But you do need the will to make it happen. It's not going to happen overnight.
I should say very briefly that they are quite selective. I mean, that you have to have very good GCSEs to get into this school.
Yeah, oh yeah, you do have to have...
So these children really are remarkable. They're properly clever, aren't
they're
they?
They have to have 8 GCSEs at grades 9 to 7, which is A to A star.
Yeah.
I didn't realise they're all... Apparently anything from a 7 above is all an A.
Yes.
It's very confusing.
It's different now.
It's very different now.
And let's have a brief word on Pilates.
Absolutely. Let's stretch out, Jane, before I leave. Now, I know you are a Pilates aficionado.
Tomorrow, 1 o'clock.
There you go. I've seen my social media algorithm serves me up all sorts of videos of men, like quite tough professional athlete men, trying Pilates, only to discover it's a lot harder than they thought it was. And we sent Simon Mills along to a male Pilates instructor in the Cotswolds who is teaching an awful lot of other men at his daughter's studio, but also in the village hall. And actually, it is becoming a much more male pastime now. And I have to say, I think that's a very, very positive thing. Pilates, when done properly, is the hardest thing ever. I used to go to one in New York where I couldn't walk for about 3 days afterwards.
Was that hot Pilates?
No, that was mega former Pilates, Jane.
Mega?
Mega former Pilates.
Okay. Can you just briefly explain what that means?
I mean, it was just incredibly hard to do. You're doing all sorts of Pilates positions on a moving bed with all these kind of contraptions and straps.
Yeah, it
I mean, I will say, if you do it religiously, you do have sort of, you know, a bum you could bounce 10p piece off, to be honest with you.
Thank you very much. Dominic says, I want to take issue with Jane. We live in Southern California. We hold parties and attend parties here all the time. And, well, we drink like fish and party till 2 in the morning.
I'm very glad to hear it, Dominic. See? Just, yeah, set the example. Well done.
I mean, I actually think it's very sensible to end at 8, but still, almost 3 now.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, this is Jane Garvey on Times Radio, and in the next hour we'll talk about the historic nature of the former Prince Andrew's arrest this morning. What does it mean for the monarchy? Times Radio's Daryl Morris will bring us a special report from Gorton and Denton. The by-election is next week in that constituency. Vassos is back with the sport. We'll talk about Arsenal and Tottenham, both have woes. And our big interview is with the journalist Felicity Spector on her book about the conflict in Ukraine. It's excellent, it's called Bread and War. Andy Hayes has the news at 3.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. King Charles says the law must take its course after his brother, Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor, was arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office relating to his time as a UK trade envoy. The King also says he learned the news with the deepest concern and says there will be a full, fair and proper process. He says the authorities have his full and wholehearted support. Andrew is held this morning on the Sandringham estate in Norfolk on his 66th birthday. The Times understands that neither he nor the King were given advance warning. Royal correspondent Sarah Hewson says Andrew's arrest follows new information found in the Epstein papers.
In those files, it appears, it is alleged that Andrew had forwarded emails that were sent to him based on his work as a UK trade envoy. So after his visits to Asia, emails and documents concerning investment opportunities.
The legal commentator Joshua Rosenberg explains what misconduct in public office means.
It could be anybody working as a public officer who willfully neglects to perform his duty or willfully misconducts himself to such a degree as to amount to an abuse of the public's trust without reasonable excuse or justification. The real question is whether the police can prove that Andrew Mountbatten Windsor willfully misconducted himself to such a degree as to amount to an abuse of the public's trust in him.
The family of Virginia Jew Frey, who alleged Andrew had sex with her when she was 17, have said in a statement, at last. They also say their hearts have been lifted. Andrew has always denied any wrongdoing. In other news, the Times understands the UK is yet to give permission for the US to use the military base on Diego Garcia and RAF Fairford in Gloucestershire in the event that Donald Trump orders a strike on Iran. Trump said last night he wants the UK to scrap the Chagos deal with Mauritius. A British couple, Craig and Lindsay Foreman, have been sentenced to 10 years in prison over allegations of spying in Iran. The Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper says their sentence is completely appalling. A man who raped a 13-year-old girl in Rotherham has been jailed for 20 years. The woman, who's now 30, confronted 45-year-old Riyath Hussain at Sheffield's Crown Court, telling him, "You didn't just steal my childhood, you stole the rest of my life." And Sir Keir Starmer has appointed Dame Antonia Romeo as Britain's first female cabinet secretary. Romeo, currently the permanent secretary of the Home Office, will replace Sir Chris Wilmot, who was sacked by Starmer last week. And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix, kitchens and bathrooms.
Good afternoon, 3 minutes past three. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio until four. Seb Payne takes over at four. Kate Borsay with you after 7 p.m. So stick with Times Radio. It is a historic day. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor arrested at around 8 o'clock this morning on suspicion of misconduct in public office. We are going to talk in a moment or two to Anna Whitelock, Professor of the History of Monarchy at City University in London. Also in this hour, we have got Vassos Alexander asking the big questions about North London Premier League teams. Could Spurs get relegated? Are Arsenal bottlers? That's the big sporting question of the day for Vassos. He's with me in about 10 minutes' time. Now, Keir Starmer is under pressure over the by-election in Gorton and Denton, which is a week away. The Prime Minister blocked the Greater Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham from standing, and there are suggestions it has hurt Labour's chances. The one-time safe seat is now thought to be threatened by both the Greens and Reform UK. Times Radio's Daryl Morris is reporting from the constituency throughout the day here on Times Radio. So, Daryl, the tale of this seat.
Hello, Jen. I can't quite hear you. I'm not sure if you asked me a question, but could you ask it again if you did?
Daryl, I will. Tell us about this seat. What sort of a place is it?
Great, I heard that one. This is a rock-solid Labour seat, Jane. This is about as safe a Labour seat as it gets, only once in its history. Actually, I should just caveat, it was new, this particular constituency, in the last election, 2024, but it's kind of requisite bits if you sort of pull them all together and kind of apply the last sort of 100 years or so to this part of the world. It's all been absolutely rock solid. The only time that Labour ever fell under 50% here was in the 1960s when one Winston Churchill stood for the Conservative Party. Not that one, it was a relative, but all the same, it was a big moment. And here we have another big moment, another huge, potentially massively consequential election here, where, you know, Labour find themselves under threat on all fronts. This constituency is telling the story of British politics. You've got a white working class community here in Denton, which is where you find me right now. I'm stood here in sort of Denton Square, Denton Town Hall behind me. This bit of the constituency, 86% white working class, work, you know, very sort of prominent working class jobs amongst this particular constituency. Further south, you have a more gentrified area with graduates and students and a sort of chunk of Muslim population as well. And the Labour Party are finding themselves losing ground in all of those places. And so Reform sniff an opportunity, the Greens sniff an opportunity, but the story of this constituency is that fragmentation.
Right. Thank you very much. I'm glad we got through to you. I know you've been speaking to voters about what's going to impact their vote on Thursday. And let's just hear from a number of them, including one gentleman called Fazan.
So in Pakistan, you have a job as a content writer. You come to the United Kingdom and you're struggling to use those skills in the workforce. Yes. And so you're working in security, which is not an unskilled job. It's a good job working
it's
in security.
It's a good job.
But it's not what you want to do.
Yes, it is a good job. Every job is a good job. I'm not saying that that is not a good job or I don't want to do that. I know many people who have skills, but they're just doing security or they're doing Uber or taxi. Most of them are in the warehouse, but they are highly skilled people.
Labour have lost a lot of support in the Muslim population because of the issue in Gaza. That seems to be sort of trending in British politics. Is that something that you're kind of aware of?
I really stand for Gaza, especially about children, because they have done nothing. A six-year-old or a six-month-old child, what's the mistake of him?
Do you think that other people feel the same?
Most of the Muslim community, yes. Almost 99.9% feel the same. I am thinking about domestic as well. Most of the people, most of the Muslim community, so they are looking for someone who will stand for the Gaza.
That's interesting, Daryl. Gaza is obviously featuring in people's thoughts. Who do you think is benefiting from that?
It definitely feels on the ground here like the Greens are benefiting from that. There is a huge amount of frustration amongst the Muslim population at the way that Labour have handled the situation in the Middle East. That's become a feature of British politics in the last few years that we've become quite familiar with. That's been tested a few times at elections. I was in Rochdale when George Galloway won that another extraordinary by-election here in the north of England in Greater Manchester just before the general election in 2024. And it feels like the same sort of thing is happening again. I think there's sort of two things to pull out of what Fazan had to say there, which was firstly the fact that it still remains an issue, Gaza, the Middle East, in a Muslim population, which isn't huge here in the same way that like it is in somewhere like Rochdale. But when you consider how fine the margins are, a three-way marginal seat, I think it's best to sort of think about this. And if those, you know, if those kind of fine margins rub up against an issue like that in one bit of the constituency that's motivating the way they vote, it could make a big difference to the result. The other thing, and so, you know, the issue of Gaza and the Middle East is still felt very keenly, despite the dust sort of having settled on it somewhat, so far as the sort of national news is concerned. The other thing to take away from what he from that conversation too, I think, is the frustration that he felt not being able to get a job that applied to his skills. And that is a sort of insecurity that you find in almost every conversation that you have in this constituency. We're going to hear later on today from somebody who is a carer, who feels as though doctors and nurses have had a pay rise that she hasn't. She talks about working to survive, not being able to really live. She says that something went wrong in the system and we're just basically picking up the pieces. You know, you even in the sort of gentrified areas, the people that you would expect to have a little bit of extra cash in their pocket are getting to the end of the month and feeling the pinch. There is a level of sort of insecurity baked into almost everybody's lived experience, and I wouldn't underestimate how that's making people think and feel as we get towards this by-election next week as well.
Right, really interesting stuff. Now, the Reform candidate has been, I think you could describe him as prominent. He's been an academic. Tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, Matt Goodwin is a very curious character. So he is somebody, if you are quite online or you followed politics closely for a while, you might be familiar with him. He is indeed an academic. He was a researcher at the University of Manchester. He famously researched radicalisation and the far right and the sort of hard right, the radical right, as he would describe it, in the United Kingdom. And he was sort of, you know, he was a sort of liberal talking head for quite a while. He's been on a political journey. He's now, some people, I was speaking to somebody the other day, he said he'd been sort of radicalised by the movement that he was researching, which is one disparaging way of putting it. He would say that he's, you know, been on a political journey that has, you know, perhaps opened his eyes to some truths. Whatever the truth of that, he is a controversial character who's been in the news for having made controversial statements. And again, I want to keep coming back to this point. that this is a constituency of potentially very fine margins. If Reform UK are going to win this seat, they need to do very well in the demographic you would expect them to do well in, and they need to make inroads into the demographic that you wouldn't expect them to do that well in. And Matt Goodwin is an interesting character, because I think when he was unveiled as the candidate, there was a concern that maybe some of the sort of more controversial opinions that he has become associated with may put off some of those people they would need to make inroads into. Well, one thing I have noticed, it's actually quite low name recognition for him. He isn't sort of, there's quite a lot of kids. I seem to have attracted a carnival in the background.
They're fans, Daryl.
Clearly, huge Times Radio fans. He has quite low name recognition. I think that's something we have to understand. So one of the things that I'm sort of picking up is that actually the amount of people who can name him, who know about him, who sort of understand and have taken in some of the sort of more controversial things that you might see on Twitter or that, you know, if you're watching very closely, is quite low. That's probably a good thing for Reform. That suggests to me that risk of him sort of putting off some of those people, if you will, may not necessarily come to bear, but I guess we'll see in a week's time.
OK, brilliant stuff. It's all going on at Denton Post Office right now. There was a lad doing wheelies behind Daryl, but he just kept going. I was really impressed. Thank you very much, Daryl. He's got his gloves on. I think it's a bit parky up there. That by-election is, of course, next week. Here's the full list of candidates. Sir Oinkalot, the official monster-raving loony party. Nick Buckley, Advance UK. Charlotte Cadden, Conservative and Unionist Party. Dan Clark, Libertarian Party. Matt Goodwin, Reform UK. Sebastian Moore, Social Democratic Party. Joseph O'Meara, Rejoin EU. Jackie Piercy, Liberal Democrats. Hannah Spencer, Green Party. Angeliki Studger, Labour Party. And Hugo Wills, Communist League Election Party. And if you need to see the full list, you can go to whocanivotefor.co.uk. Times Radio, and 13 minutes now past three. The former Prince Andrew's arrest on suspicion of misconduct in public office is unprecedented in modern history. Let's attempt to put things in context. Here's Anna Whitelock, Professor of the History of Monarchy at City University in London. Anna, I'm just going to let you loose, really. What do you want to say about this?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely unprecedented. The last time that a senior royal was arrested was Charles I, can you believe it? Way back in the 17th century, in the mid-1600s, in the midst of the English Civil War. So, you know, three centuries ago, a huge moment. I think in some ways, not surprising. I think we probably assumed that an arrest at some point would come of Andrew. But still, I mean, just really stark and dramatic headlines. Of course, I think the king will be relieved, as far as he might be relieved in these circumstances, that it's Andrew Mountbatten Windsor rather than Prince Andrew that is over the headlines. But of course, despite his statement, where he clearly tried to put clear blue water between Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, who he refers to simply as that, I mean, there's no sense of the fact that they're brothers. And then ends that statement by saying simply, you know, me and my family will carry on with our duty and service to you all. I mean, I think, you know, it does raise questions about what do people want the royal family to be doing now? This kind of carrying on, not saying anything. Yes, it's appropriate in the midst of a live police investigation, but there are inevitably going to be questions at some point by the police and others, perhaps, about what was known by members of the royal family, who may themselves need to be interviewed to find out what they knew about Andrew's activities as a trade envoy, any documents, any papers, any diaries or accounts of where he was and what he was doing. So I don't think this is going to stay away from the royal family. And of course, this is simply allegations based on improper conduct in public office. This is not anything yet to do with the wider investigation about some of those other Epstein allegations.
Right. This is the point at which I need to insert that Andrew Mountbatten Windsor denies any wrongdoing. Just on a human level, whatever you think about the monarchy, and particularly right now, you have to feel some sympathy for Charles in all this. I gather we were talking earlier to the Sunday Times royal editor, Roy Anika. Charles never wanted Andrew to get this trade envoy role. Indeed, he warned against it. Charles is not in great health, and this whole thing has overshadowed his entire reign so far. It's grim, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it really is. I mean, it puts the whole sort of spat between Harry and Meghan and the King, you know, it's pretty small fry. I mean, yeah, this has cast a long shadow for many, many years, right back into the days of the late Queen. And indeed, I mean, Andrew stood down as trade envoy in 2011 because of his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein and also because of other allegations around sort of deals he was making or company he was keeping at that time. And it's important to remember that, you know, although this is focusing on the palace and the royal family, it was the government, the Foreign Office and the Department of Trade and Industry that appointed Andrew trade envoy. And indeed, when he stepped down from that role, David Cameron, Prime Minister at the time, applauded Andrew for all the work that he had done. So this actually, you know, straddles the divide between the royals, the palace and indeed Parliament or government and politics. It really, the tentacles of this investigation and Epstein more broadly really do go everywhere as part of the establishment. And so, yeah, I mean, personally for the King, a really difficult time. And although he will be able to now say, I can't comment why there is a live police investigation, questions about Andrew are going to continue. And there's potentially, you know, further allegations to be investigated and maybe future arrests to be made.
Yes. And of course, people are bound to ask who knew what and when. Can I just put this question to you from a listener called Eileen? And she's not the only person to have asked this. Can Andrew Mountbatten Windsor carry on being eighth in line to the throne? Could something be done about this? I mean, we need to say he's been arrested, he hasn't been charged, and he denies any wrongdoing. But what do you say about that?
Well, there would need to be, that would need to be subject to an act of parliament, and that could happen. I think there's a sense that, you know, it wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't want to waste parliamentary time given that he is so far down the line of succession. But of course, some people think, you know, absolutely everything should be done to literally remove him from any association with the monarchy. I mean, I think what's also just quite interesting, of course, is that if he was to be charged and found himself in court, it would, of course, be the Crown against Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. Yeah. In other words, the King against his brother, which almost sounds medieval.
Well, it does.
It's feuding.
And of course, he hasn't been charged yet.
Absolutely not.
And he says he's not done anything wrong. Let's go back to the only time a sibling of a serving monarch has been arrested. And that was when Elizabeth Tudor, who went on to become arguably England's greatest monarch, was arrested in 1554. What were the circumstances there?
Yeah, I'd argue with you about Elizabeth being the greatest monarch.
Okay.
I think she's overrated. But anyway, that's
what?
A separate... I know. Come on. What did she do? She didn't even try and marry and have an heir, where her sister...
Hang on a minute. She didn't marry because her father had chopped her mother's head off. I can see her point.
Well, hold on a second. I would argue that her sister Mary, who did imprison Elizabeth in 1554, as you correctly say, I would say that Mary, who was the daughter of Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon, was the most underrated monarch in history, that her sister managed to take the plaudits for being the female monarch as if she was the first female monarch, when in fact it was Mary. And yeah, you're right. Mary, Elizabeth was in prison for a time when she was seen as a threat to Mary's throne. And what's interesting, in a way, in when we look back in the sort of depths of history, it was the royal family themselves who would have been kind of exacting justice, or what they saw was justice, against members of their family. They wouldn't have waited for, you know, there wasn't any police force or law authority. So it was a case of them imprisoning any wrong'un and potentially taking action against them. So, different times, but I'm happy to debate with you on Elizabeth anytime.
Okay. I think it's fair to say that this is the only situation in which Andrew Mountbatten Windsor has anything in common with Elizabeth I. I think we can probably all agree on that. Anna, lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. That is Anna Whitelock, Professor Anna Whitelock, who is a Professor of the History of Monarchy at City University in London. Oh, Kate wants to start a fight. Wasn't the first female monarch Matilda? Well, I don't know. Perhaps we'll try and get Anna back to go through our favourite monarchs. Coming up after 3:30, journalist Felicity Spector discusses her work in Ukraine. Now, every day at this time, you'll hear an interview with a brilliant guest. And if you miss it, there's no problem because you can catch up on the podcast Off Air with Jane and Fee, which drops Monday to Thursday at around 6 o'clock. There are always good interviews in the pod. Lately, who have we had? The Australian literary great Helen Garner, the actor Derek Jacobi, Carol Vorderman. And I also talked to Lady Glenconner, former lady-in-waiting to Princess Margaret. Now, she told me that the late Queen did spoil Andrew.
It was this thing after the war that we wanted to spoil our children, I think.
Yes.
And I think that's probably what she did.
You and your circle who spent time with the royal family, were there mutterings about the way Andrew conducted himself?
Well, not really. I mean, I didn't see him very much. He was quite forceful. I mean, I remember him snatching toys away from my son a bit like that.
Even as a baby?
Yeah, he was a handful. I think that's what his nanny called him, a handful.
Lady Glenconner, just one of the guests we've had on Off Air with Jane and Fee. You can find that wherever you get your podcasts from. There are some funny interviews in the pod. There are also some serious ones as well. Notably, this week I spoke to Stefan Babineau, Giselle Pellico's lawyer, and he was very interesting. And yesterday we had a great guest as well, the space scientist Dame Maggie Adairan. And from now on, you'll be able to watch all of our big interviews on our newly launched YouTube channel. Go to Off Air with Jane and Fee on YouTube. This is Times Radio. Did Arsenal bottle their chances of glory in the Premier League? That's next. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio with Wix. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Explore all the sale offers at wix.co.uk or visit your local Wix store.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
We'll bring you all the latest from President Trump's inaugural Board of Peace meeting in Washington. We're going to be joined with Hugh Lovett, a senior policy fellow with Middle East expertise at the European Council on Foreign Relations, to get an insight on proceedings. And on Newsmaker this Thursday, we're joined by the author Lionel Shriver with her provocative new book. It's called A Better Life. It explores what happens when progressive immigration meets reality.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
This year at Amazon, we're increasing the electric vehicles used for deliveries across Europe to over 10,000. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where babies are made a fuss of, where we deliver footballs for kids' kickabouts, and where they deliver the football straight into next door's garden. Can they have their ball back, please? We're delivering change where it matters, on your doorstep. Based on projected delivery service partner vehicles across the UK and EU by end of 2026.
McDonald's wraps. All flavour, no mess. No drips on your drip or grease on your shirt. No crumbs on your keyboard or sauce on your dashboard. Just all the flavour of sweet chilli chicken, barbecue and bacon chicken and new Tikka chicken. Wrapped up neat. Served after 11 a.m. Tikka chicken wrap available until the 13th July 26. Fees apply to delivery orders, subject to availability.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens, helping create kitchens to feel proud of. From expert design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Learn more at wix.co.uk.
Vassos Alexander joins us every day to talk sport at around this time. Now, pressure mounting on Arsenal as their hopes of winning the Premier League took a dent last night. They blew a 2-0 lead against Wolves, conceding a dramatic 94th-minute equaliser at Molineux. Meanwhile, Spurs are at risk of being dragged into a relegation scrap. They're now a puny 5 points above the bottom three, having failed to win any of their last 8 Premier League games. Vassos, what happened to Arsenal last night then?
North London, I mean, terrible. Honestly. Yes, so, the question is, which B is it? Is it a blip or is it a bottle? Mm. The first I heard of the fact, because they were 2-0 up and cruising against a team that are guaranteed relegated, Wolves. And, you know, this is top against bottom of the Premier League and Arsenal are 2-0 up. So I sort of lost interest in the game. Yeah. I thought I gave Arsenal the 3 points. And then I get a text from my friend Matthew, who's an Arsenal season ticket holder. And he says it feels horribly deja vu. And I thought, no, surely they can't have. And they did. And it was Calafiori who'd only just come on in the 93rd minute, who then scored a 94th minute own goal to give Wolves the equaliser. Second again, ole ole, sang the Wolves fans. And it is, I mean, it would be four times in a row that Arsenal came second, and this is what
really
happened.
Four times?
Well, it's three, and now it would be four. So wow. They've got 11 games left. Manchester City have 12 games left, and the gap at the top is 5 points with Manchester City against Arsenal to come in a few weeks' time at the Etihad.
Oh, so they're still to play.
So okay. If they both win, if Arsenal win everything, they'll be champions. If Man City win everything, they'll be champions.
Oh, that's quite interesting, isn't it? Mm. Arteta, he must be fuming. Well, he did look as though he was.
You could just tell from the... I mean, I've watched it back now, and you could tell from the body language. Just he went from fuming manager on the sidelines, saying to his players, just stop giving Wolves the ball, to a sort of... to a shell of a human being, like I am when I'm watching Fulham and we're 1-0 up and we're just desperately... just wishing time away, just hoping for the final whistle.
Let it stop.
Yes, let it stop. And it didn't stop. And Wolves equalised. And so Arsenal really are on a pretty terrible run of form. I think they've only won three of their last eight Premier League games. And traditionally, they don't play well in the last 10 or 12 games of the season. Yeah, and Manchester City... So, I mean, it feels bottle, but it could be blip.
It's a psychological thing, surely. But, I mean, the personnel come and go, don't they? I know there have been some constants over those four campaigns. But what is it about that mentality thing?
It's really interesting. They haven't won the league since 2004, Arsenal. Mikel Arteta has spent pretty much £1 billion. And this season, we spent the first two-thirds almost of this season saying, well, this is obviously Arsenal's title. They play, it has to be said, slightly boring football, but it's designed to win them matches. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they score from corners, and they're, you know, they're pretty solid at the back, and they've got cover in every position.
I mean, Saka, they've got Rice, they've got great players.
They bought Eze, you know, they've sort of made sure that in every position, if there's a big injury, they've got a big player to come in. And so we just said, look, this is Arsenal's title, let's move on and let's be interested in who goes down, for example. But actually, it turns out... And a few weeks ago, do you remember we talked about the Manchester City-Liverpool game with that goal that wasn't at the end? Mm-hmm. Well, 10 minutes before the end of that game, Arsenal were 9 points clear. And now they're 5 points clear and City have a game in hand and here we go again.
Oh, but it's entertaining.
It isn't it just? And it's sort... I mean, sorry, Arsenal fans. It's sort of funny.
It is. If you haven't got any skin in the game, it's just funny. Talking of funny, Spurs. I mean, are they too big a club to be relegated?
So Arsenal, Tottenham, Chelsea, Manchester United, Liverpool and Everton are the only Premier League ever presence. But there is a lovely piece in the Times today, and you can see it online, written by Bill Edgar, about the big, big clubs that have gone down in history. Newcastle United, just after they were beaten by Juventus in the Champions League. But then the decline on the pitch, and did you remember they had loads of different managers, and eventually Alan Shearer took charge and he couldn't stop them going down, and Kevin Keegan was involved as well. And, you know, there are big clubs that have gone down. And the thing is, it's weird. They're the Europa League champions, Tottenham, and they've brought in this new manager, Igor Tudor.
Who's new to Britain, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They call him the ferryman, or maybe he calls himself the ferryman, because he will shepherd passengers to safety, or clubs to safety. Mm. This is his 12th job in his 6th different country in 13 years. So he'll be in Enfield now, where Tottenham train, getting used to the weather. He's from Croatia. His last job was manager of Juventus, actually, which lasted till October. And he'll be trying to get Tottenham to sort of buy into his very attacking, very front foot style of play. But the worry for Spurs is, and they like that, the fans at Spurs, but the worry is they have a huge injury crisis. And that sort of, that high intensity does seem to, as they found out last season, does seem to prompt injuries, and they can't afford any more. So it might be a good appointment till the end of the season, or, you know, and they haven't won any of their last eight games, as you said, or are they sliding towards the bottom three? It seems like it's West Ham or Nottingham Forest or Tottenham to join Burnley and Wolves, who looked, I'm afraid, doomed.
Yeah, I spent that entire answer wondering whether it was worth saying this, but I am going to say it. Is he doing the job for free, bearing in mind he's a ferryman?
I don't get this, no.
Don't pay the ferryman.
Oh, okay. I sort of get it now.
Okay, right. Vassals, thank you.
What is Don't Pay the Ferryman?
It's a massive hit by Chris de Burgh.
Okay.
Is it? I'm just looking. I'm going to ask Ryan, see if he can find it. I think I might be going mad. I think I might, one of those days where there's just been too much news.
There has been a lot of news.
It is a hit song by Christopher.
Then I apologise for not getting it.
It's all right, Bessos. You are a little bit younger than me. Thank you for coming in. Together with Wix, we want to know your proudest moment of the week to be in with a chance to win a £250 Wix voucher in our Wix Peacock Awards. It's the highlight of the week, isn't it, Bessos?
It is.
Apart from my hilarious gags. Rob, it wasn't really a gag, was it? Hang on. Tansy says he obviously called the ferryman because he takes a boat from job to job. Yes. Okay.
Yes, okay, that too.
That too, thank you. Rob says, I bought an old bike for £20 from a local charity shop and spent time fixing it up. What began as a simple repair turned into something far more meaningful. The bike became the one that carried my four-year-old grandson on two wheels for the very first time. Seeing him race around our close, wobble-free and full of confidence was so satisfying. The bike I'd rescued now had a new life, and so did he, discovering independence, balance and pure joy. We both wore broad smiles that day, sharing a powerful sense of achievement and pride. It might be a small moment, says Rob, but it's one I will always treasure.
See, he tugs at the heartstrings with that, doesn't he?
That's fantastic. Mm. Yeah, very hard to resist that one, Rob, but it's going on the pile. Thank you. Here we are. How could you not have heard of that?
7 years at Virgin Radio, another seven at Radio 2, and I don't think I've ever heard this song before.
Thank you, Ryan, for being there. Honestly, why do I come in? Vessels, thank you very much. You've worked with other people. You haven't worked with the best until quite recently, Vessels, when you joined Fee and I here.
True dat.
It's Times Radio coming up. Felicity Spector on her book about Ukraine, bread and war. Here are the headlines. Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. King Charles says the law must take its course after his brother Andrew Mountbatten Windsor was arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office relating to his time as a UK trade envoy. The King was asked if he had any comment as he arrived at an event in London this afternoon but did not reply. Andrew is held this morning on the Sandringham estate in Norfolk on his 66th birthday. The Times understands that neither he nor the King were given advance warning. Addresses are being searched both in Norfolk and in Berkshire. Home Affairs commentator Danny Shaw says Andrew will be processed like any other suspect.
There's going to be no special treatment for him. He will be booked into the custody suite. He will be fingerprinted. He will have his DNA taken on arrest. That's the same for every single suspect in a police station. He'll go up to the desk. The custody sergeant will say to him, go through his details and say, you know, are you on medication? Are there any health issues we need to be aware of?
Andrew has always denied any wrongdoing. The Times understands the UK has yet to give permission for the US to use the military base on Diego Garcia and RAF Fairford in Gloucestershire in the event that Donald Trump orders a strike on Iran. Trump said last night he wants the UK to scrap the Chagos deal with Mauritius. And Keir Starmer's appointed Dame Antonia Romeo as Britain's first female cabinet secretary. Romeo, currently the permanent secretary at the Home Office, will replace Sir Chris Wormald, who was sacked by Starmer last week. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Don't miss the last few days of the biggest Furniture Village sale of the year. It's your last chance to save with final reductions on many sofas, dining, beds and bedroom furniture. But hurry, many offers end Sunday at Furniture Village, a world-class family business.
Discover the world of Dobble, back in McDonald's Happy Meal. Race through the worlds of music, sports, space and more. How quickly can your little one spot the match? Dobble's bursting with fun. Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 5th of March 2026, from 11 a.m, includes one pre-selected book or toy. Dobble range comprises toys only, while stocks last.
The To-Do List. Expert recommendations for the best TV, film and music. Sunday nights from 11:30 with Daryl Morris.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles, whether it's your first home or your forever home. Find your dream kitchen at Wix. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free kitchen design appointment today at wix.co.uk.
25 minutes to four. Don't forget, Seb Payne takes you through the late afternoon and evening here on Times Radio. And there will be more coverage of the big story of the day, the arrest of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor on suspicion of misconduct in public office. Then Kate Borsay starts here on Times Radio at 7 o'clock with guests including the novelist Lionel Shriver. Let's go, though, to our big guest in the afternoon. It's Felicity Spector today, who is the author of a book called Bread and War, a Ukrainian story of food, bravery and hope. Now, Felicity is not only a senior Channel 4 journalist, she has Ukrainian heritage, and she felt compelled to get involved following the Russian invasion almost 4 years ago. She's also a foodie and a keen baker, and she's been supporting the non-profit organisation Bake for Ukraine, which now has three mobile bakeries and provides much-needed sustenance to people in isolated parts of the country. It's been a particularly brutal winter in Ukraine, with continuous Russian strikes on infrastructure, which have left so many people without power and water. Yesterday, peace talks once again concluded without any real sign of a breakthrough. I asked Felicity about her personal ties to Ukraine.
I never met my grandparents. They died a long time before I was born. So when they left, it was more than 100 years ago. But I'd always been really, really fascinated with the whole region, but never really spent a lot of time in Ukraine, very sadly. Very brief visit when I was the Moscow producer back in the early 90s when it was declared independent. And I kept meaning to go. And I now really, really wish I'd gone before the full-scale war because, you know, it would have been amazing to see it without all this trauma that's going on there at the moment.
There are some positives, not least that you went back to Dnipro and you discovered that there was a flourishing Jewish community there again.
Yes, that's right. It's one of the biggest Jewish communities in Ukraine, also in Odessa, where I frequently travel. And I went to visit the chief rabbi and met him and then went round to a matzah factory, which was producing these handmade kosher matzah, which then gets sold around the world. And it was really amazing to see that whole process. It's very carefully run with rabbinical supervision and everything. And given that making and eating matzahs was illegal during Soviet times, it was really a symbol of how the Jewish community has gone back to life and is helping the city as well, because the Jewish community is very tied in with the rest of the city. And they provide a lot of services, not just for other Jewish people, but for the rest of society.
Yes, I mean, I definitely got the impression from your book that though they were doing lots of outreach, as to be fair, were quite a number of churches as well.
Yes, I mean, we have also worked, the charity that I help out, Bake for Ukraine, we helped to build a bakery underneath a church in an area of Kharkiv called Saltivka, which is one of the biggest housing estates. It's probably the biggest in that city, but because it's on the eastern side, it bore the brunt of Russian attacks. And people who were living there at the beginning of the full-scale war were living in basements, and it was really, really dangerous there. And this church had been helping to feed people and to shelter people. And somehow they got the idea that they wanted to create a bakery. And then they saw something about Bake for Ukraine and reached out. And we went there and I checked out what the facilities were like. And then the girls managed to find some equipment going cheap because of somewhere had closed down and sent it all over to them. And one of their parishioners installed everything for free. And they've got a bakery down there now, which feeds people and they give away free bread to the local area.
Felicity, how did all this start? I appreciate you had a familial link to Ukraine and to the Jewish community there through your grandparents. You're also a journalist. You'd spent time in Russia. But how did you go from that to a real passion for the country and starting this charity and helping it so much?
So it was really, well, you will know Olya Hercules, the Ukrainian cook and cookbook writer who's been living in England for 20 years. She is a good friend of mine. And at the beginning of the full-scale war, she started fundraising immediately and set up a charity called Cook for Ukraine. And I was helping that to raise money. And we had a bake sale that another friend of mine organised. And we were trying to use the hashtag Bake for Ukraine. And we thought, oh, somebody else is using it. Who are these people? And when I checked them out, I saw that they were doing really, really good work. And I had also been in touch with another bakery with a view to filming, sending our correspondent to film with them at the beginning of the war because they were baking underground and feeding soldiers and things. And that didn't work out, but I stayed in touch with them. And their warehouse was bombed. and they lost all their supplies and all their spare equipment. And I thought, I bet I know people who have, you know, loads of bakeries. They renew their equipment and it works perfectly well. Maybe they'll donate it. So I reached out to people I knew, and within 48 hours, I had everything that this Kiev bakery needed. And then I found some people who could drive it there. And I thought, all right, let's do a convoy. And I'd never done a convoy of things a country at war before. But, there we are. It was very kind and welcoming people. Everyone was super helpful. And then when I found out that Bake for Ukraine were working in lots of areas which were quite near to the front line or in the deoccupied areas, and they were supporting small bakeries which were giving away free bread there, I thought, well, that sounds really important. And, you know, it's very hard to raise money inside Ukraine because obviously everyone's income has suffered. So they were really grateful for foreign support at that point. And I went to meet them in Odessa, and then we just became really, really good friends. And then I went to visit all the projects that they were supporting. And I thought, God, you don't know about this from outside. How many people are involved in this incredible volunteering effort when life is already really, really hard for them? But their motivation is to help other people who are even worse off. And I thought, this is really incredible and really admirable.
Yeah,
so I wanted to do everything I could to help them.
What comes across so brilliantly in your book, Bread and War, is that quiet heroism of so-called ordinary people who, for whatever reason, are able to go above and beyond to attempt to help others. But I'm glad you mentioned that so many people's income has dropped. I think we sometimes forget that, don't we? How are the majority of the Ukrainian population getting by?
Well, it has been really, really difficult for people. I mean, for many, many reasons. I mean, prices there have gone up in the same way that they have everywhere. So, you know, the cost of food and fuel and all that kind of stuff has shot up. Also, because of the blackouts, there are constant electricity blackouts because the Russians keep bombing the civilian infrastructure. So people have to have small businesses have to have generators, and the cost of the fuel for that is astronomical. And at home, you know, people have got to start trying to work out how to get, you know, hot water to wash and things like that. And all these solutions, it don't come very cheaply because a lot of men are in the army. Obviously, their income, you know, that they may have been supporting the family with has really, really shrunk because you don't get paid that much in the armed forces. Or people's jobs have gone because businesses have gone under or had to pull out. So a lot of those issues have really, really hit people's incomes. But, you know, obviously the cost of living there is lower than it is here. But some cities, especially if people have tried to flee to the west of Ukraine to get away from the more dangerous areas, the prices of housing there is pretty expensive now. So some people have gone back to sort of frontline cities because they said they can't afford to live in the west of Ukraine.
Really? Could you give us an idea of how much rent would be in the west of Ukraine?
Gosh, I don't know. I haven't never rented anywhere, but I think that because incomes there are a lot lower, but you could certainly pay, you know, $1,500 or something a month or something.
Right,
you know, so that's a lot.
A good chunk of what income is available. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to people who say, well, food, I mean, East European food, it's stodge, nothing more to it. What do you say?
I mean, there is, obviously, it's good. I mean, at the moment, it's really cold, so people need the kind of, you know, cheap and nutritious type of food. But I mean, just, I always like that kind of food anyway. I love borscht. I love these amazing pancakes called syrniki, which are like made from curd cheese. You have them for breakfast with jam. I mean, what's not to love? Cheesecake for breakfast, you know, it's beautiful. And the quality of the fruit and vegetables there's a lot of fresh produce on sale in markets, open air or covered markets, and it's really, really high quality. And they do a lot of fermentation and pickling and stuff, not because it's trendy, but because that's the way you preserve stuff over the cold winter months. And that's all really delicious. You can get sort of fermented apples and plums and really juicy and, you know, delicious. And lots of the heartier dishes, things like dumplings stuffed with potatoes and onions. It's just really welcome on a cold day, I have to say.
That there's a lot of writing in the book about, I don't know, quite sensuous stuff about the food. And you describe something you had in Dnipro, because I made a note of this, a hummus plate garlanded with fried potatoes and aubergine, chopped salad and a fudgy soft-boiled egg. I could eat that now. That sounds absolutely lush.
Yeah, so could I. That was a fantastic place, actually, called Moshe. And I had these two friends who were helping me to do the translation when I was there. There's a really lovely network of people who are always sort of like, you can find someone to sort of help out anywhere in the country, really. And they were very plugged into the Jewish community. And they said, we know exactly where to take you for breakfast. So we went there. And there's a lot of that. Like, I've got friends that I stay with in Kyiv, and they're always sort of sending me little messages about, oh, this new place opened, you might be interested. And this chef that I met, I actually wrote about in the Sunday Times, an amazing young baker, and he opened a place. He had his own bakery that did goods for other cafes and things. It was like a B2B operation, but he was doing sourdough, really high quality stuff, milled his own flour, bought a mill. So that's in the middle of Kyiv with a mill. And he has his own cafe and makes absolutely incredible pastries that you would be bowled over to find anywhere in the world, really, and just amazing quality and sort of craftsmanship that goes into them.
You also pay tribute to the army cooks, particularly those near the front line. I was really, really struck by this because the guys there, and I know I appreciate they're not all men, although the vast majority are, that they need thousands of calories a day. How is that done?
So it's quite patchy, I have to say. And I know that I went to the ones that were sort of the rather better examples, because I've got friends who've said, oh, God, you get sort of a type of porridge three times a day if you're lucky. But they have a system, a sort of centralized system where they allocate, I think it's a certain number of calories per day, and they send the ingredients out to the units. So it's sort of calculated according to what energy they'll be using by carrying heavy gear and stuff. But for a lot of the guys in the positions, which is in the more front line, like right by the line of contact and stuff, it's really difficult. You basically have these kind of meals ready to eat that they have in all the other armies. We just mix hot water into a packet of something and right, sort of hope for the best, because you can't carry any, especially now with the drone warfare, it's really, really impossible sometimes for the guys to leave their positions because there's so many drones flying overhead that it's too dangerous. So they get stuck there for sort of weeks on end. So they have to have enough rations with them. And the Ukrainians have started dropping food by drone as well to people, food and water. They become quite ingenious because supply routes, when it's impossible to drive by road or to send things in by any other means of transport, they've got to think of a way around that.
But there is no doubt that what you eat, wherever you are in the world, it is significant. And if you are well fed, well, surely that's going to make you feel slightly better. I mean, there's a really interesting bit where you mention an army cook called Ruslan. Is that the right pronunciation?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now he is. I appreciate that standards vary across the army in Ukraine. But for breakfast that day, they'd made burgers, you say in the book.
Yes.
While the lunch menu was far more elaborate than you might imagine. Borscht, deviled eggs stuffed with fried onion and mushrooms, trays of meatballs, and what Ruslan called field pizza, toasted bread topped with a mix of minced beef, tomatoes and herbs. I mean, that seems incredibly adventurous for conditions that must be, well, to put it mildly, unpredictable.
Well, in that particular scenario, they were living in some sort of old cottages in a village that was about 40 miles back. So they were on the border of Kherson region. And so they had the opportunity. There was a sort of kitchen there, but they mainly cooked outside. I think they used the kitchen area for storage. So they had this sort of wood fire and a sort of barbecue type construction that they'd built. So they could cook things quite easily over that with these huge pots. And because the guys, they were Marines. So when they go to the front line, they're in the most difficult spot. So I think while they were in this area to the rear, they wanted to kind of recoup and give the guys back some energy that they were going to need for the next mission.
Yeah.
But yes, he wasn't even a professional cook. He was somebody who'd been in the Marines and really wanted to cook and then just took to it and was really enthusiastic about it.
And other people that you interview had been cooks professionally and joined up to share their expertise because they felt it was worthwhile. You do ask Ruslan if there are any vegetarians or vegans, and there aren't.
I do know a vegan, actually. So there's a paperback edition of my book coming out in April, and we chose a different picture for the cover, and it shows a guy who was then a baker and subsequently joined the armed forces. And he's a Buddhist vegan. And I remember when he first joined, a friend of mine said, oh, can you help us to find some vegan food for him? Because when he was in the training camp, there wasn't many options. And so there was a charity who was sending out vegan food to soldiers. So they immediately sent him a sort of care package.
Wow.
But he's managed to keep up his vegan diet. I mean, I don't know how varied it is. There's a lot of buckwheat, I expect, but I guess that's nutritious.
Well, I mean, look, good for him. He's got his principles and he's sticking to them, and he's a lot braver than I am. What about the peace talks, which ground to a halt, ended yesterday? No optimism, it would seem. I think President Zelensky just continues to feel that he's always being asked to make concessions, and Putin isn't. I mean, I know it's difficult for you to assess, but what is the mood? Are people just beyond despondent?
I mean, I think what's made people exhausted and tired this winter is this energy, these energy blackouts. You can't imagine how it's been absolutely freezing. And a lot of people have had virtually no heating. They've had a couple of hours a day, and they've got ice on the inside of the windows, but they kind of adapt. So they've created these invincibility points in big cities like Kyiv and Sumy, where you can go inside a sort of yurt type structure or inside a train station, and there'll be places where you can recharge your phone and get hot drinks. And loads of the big charities like World Central Kitchen have provided, you know, hot food for people. So that's kind of keeping spirits up. And I think it's almost like hardened the line when people see or imagine. I can't imagine really why they're being treated so unfairly. It kind of makes them think, well, you know, we're not going to give up. Why would we surrender our land to this, you know, to the Russians when they, you know, they're the ones who invaded in the first place? It's a very easy way to stop the war, and it's for Russia to go home and, you know, go back to their own country, with probably some more four-letter words scattered through that. But it's, you know, that's what people think. It's like, well, why, hang on, you know, this is our country. We never asked for this war. Why are we being told to, you know, to give our land up when, you know, we've fought for these 4 years? People lots of people have sadly died, and you see a lot of injured guys with, you know, with amputations and so on. They don't want to then throw away all of that sacrifice that people have made just for nothing.
So the idea of some sort of peace deal soon, which we know is what President Trump wants, followed by elections, what do you think?
I can't imagine. It's up to the Russians, really. I mean, the Russians are the ones who could end this, as I said, and they are the ones who he should be putting the pressure on, because there's not much point putting pressure on Ukrainians, because then you can see how they've resisted the incredible onslaught of the Russian army for 4 years, when nobody thought that they could manage 3 days. They're not the type of people who sort of give up and surrender. So the only way to stop the war is to make the Russians stop the war.
When are you next going back?
Today.
And where are you going?
So I'm going out to, I'll be in Odessa, where our Bake for Ukraine team is based. And then I'll go to Mykolaiv as well, which is where our mobile bakery is based. And the girls have been building a new bakery for the team in a kind of underground area so that they can bake there through the year. Whatever's going on outside. It's been very, very cold, so it's been really impossible to use the mobile bakery, because it's like minus 25, so they can't really work outside. So that's why we've decided to create them this new space. So they supply bread to these villages, which are really, really hard to get to with hardly any proper roads. So it's been really vital to have that support. So I'll go and visit them, and then I'll go up to Kyiv in time for the anniversary, the 4 year anniversary, which is another sad milestone, but one that's you know, people are determined to show that they're here and they're not going anywhere.
The journalist and author Felicity Spector, and we wish her a very safe return trip to Ukraine. It's incredible, isn't it? 4 years just about since the Russian invasion. Her book is Bread and War, a Ukrainian story of food, bravery and hope. And the non-profit organisation she helps, if you're in a position to help as well, it is called Bake for Ukraine. Now, coming up, and I bet you're excited, the winner of this week's Proud as a Peacock Award. It is approximately 6 minutes. No, it's exactly 6 minutes to four. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Weekend afternoons on Times Radio with Wild Frontiers. Go beyond the headlines and explore the human experiences at the heart of the week's news agenda, with well-informed debate and thoughtful insight, tailor-made for anyone looking to broaden their horizons, not follow the herd. Plus, get an expertly curated guide to the best the weekend has to offer, whether you're staying in or looking for an adventure. This Saturday afternoon from 1 on Times Radio with Wild Frontiers. Never stop seeking with Wild Frontiers. Travel.com.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working, offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
Global events.
There's a warning that the impact of climate change is getting more severe and we're not prepared.
Breaking news.
Following allegations of potential fraud raised by The Times.
Reactive analysis.
What's going on in the government about discussion of extremism?
From the world's best journalists.
We're trying to look at some of the questions about migration and the implications for the economy, jobs and public services.
On DAB, online, on the app and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
The Wickes Peacock Awards on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms. The Wickes Kitchen and Bathroom Sale is on. Explore all the sale offers at wickes.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wickes store.
So, the big question is, who gets to win this week's Proud as a Peacock Wickes Award, £250 worth of Wickes vouchers? Well, a special shout out to John, who says, I'm proud as a peacock. I'm proud of my 1,310 and counting blood platelet donations. That is impressive. The story about the bike, I have to say, Rob, you so nearly got there because I thought that was very touching, that bike that you'd bought for 20 quid and you'd done it up and you'd let your grandson loose on it and he was just so joyous when he first learnt to ride it. But I think you've kind of had the pleasure of seeing him do it. So the winner this week is, and thank you for all the entries because they are just a burst of sunshine in this bleak old winter and on some tough news days, it has to be said. This is from RJ. I would like to nominate our local church warden, Dorothy Garbutt. She's 80, I think, although I have never been rude enough to ask. She has almost single-handedly kept our tiny, beautiful 12th century church at Scorton in North Yorkshire alive and vibrant for the last 50 years. She's a local farmer. She spent all her married life on a farm just outside the village. She's a marvellous woman, and I think she'd definitely spend the voucher on the church or possibly the village reading room. Now, honestly, how could I not give the fantastic-sounding Dorothy that Wickes voucher? And RJ, thank you very much for sharing news of her with us. We hugely appreciate it. Right, I think it's time for the important Wickes Jungle? No, I mean the Wickes Jingle. Here we go.
The Wickes Peacock Awards on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms. The Wickes Kitchen and Bathroom Sale is on. Explore all the sale offers at wickes.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wickes store.
So congratulations to Dorothy and to RJ who nominated her, and we'll be in touch to get the details we need, RJ. Thank you. Those Wickes vouchers will be making their way to Yorkshire very soon. And if you'd like the chance to win next week's £250 Wickes voucher, get in early. Why not send us your proudest moment of your most recent week? You can do it on WhatsApp, but honestly, I think you're probably better off emailing us at this stage in the game. It's janeandfee@times.radio. Now, there is no doubt that the big story of the day has been the arrest of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, and that story will be followed here on Times Radio through the course of the evening. But it is just worth noting that royal life is very much carried on as normal. The King has been out and about. He has opened, I understand, London Fashion Week, and the Princess Royal has ventured north. She's been visiting a prison in Yorkshire. So very much keeping at it and not letting recent events affect their schedule, which is in its own way impressive. I think we have to honour that. Now, next week, Fee is back, which will be good. Looking forward to that. And we have some cracking guests lined up. One of my favourite authors, Ellie Griffiths, who's written another of her time travelling tomes. I absolutely love those. We've got Ian Russell, Molly Russell's father, who does some really important campaigning on young people and social media. And Harriet Tice, her of Traitors. She's also a novelist. She has a new thriller out, and she is going to be fascinating. She joins us next week. My thanks to Felix Forbes and our technical operator who dug out that fabulous Christopher for me, Ryan Boyden. Yes, I'm in my 60s. What of it? John Pienaar is not next with Drive because he's off today. It's Seb Payne. Have a good weekend.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
It's 4 o'clock. You're listening to Seb Payne in for John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive. The headlines. King Charles has said the law must take its course after expressing his deepest concern over the arrest of his younger brother, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. And the Times understands the UK is yet to give permission for the US to use the military base on Diego Garcia and RAF Fairford in Gloucestershire in the event Donald Trump orders a strike on Iran. Coming up on the programme, all you need to know about Andrew Mountbatten Windsor's arrest. We'll cross live to Windsor and Sandringham, where the former prince's property is being searched. And an open letter has been issued to Keir Starmer from former military chiefs, urging him to deliver an immediate increase in defence spending. I'm joined by the former head of the British Army, Lord Dannett, who is one of the signatories.
This is Times Radio.
All that on the way, but first, the latest news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Seb. Good afternoon. King Charles says the law must take its course after his brother, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, was arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office relating to his time as a UK trade envoy. The King was asked if he had any comment as he arrived at an event in London this afternoon, but did not reply. Andrew was held this morning on the Sandringham estate in Norfolk on his 66th birthday. The Times understands that neither he nor the King were given advance warning. Addresses are being searched both in Norfolk and in Berkshire. Home Affairs commentator Danny Shaw describes what faces Andrew at a police station.
He will be led into a police cell. The door will be slammed shut behind him, and he will be in that cell by himself with just a bed and a toilet for company until such time that the police decide to conduct interviews, and in which case they'll take him to a police interview room and he will be interviewed. He will have the opportunity of having a lawyer present, either the duty solicitor, or he can ask for his own lawyer to be present.
The historian A.N. Wilson says Andrew's arrest is unprecedented.
There's nobody in the history of the royal family as clodhoppingly awful as Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. That's not to say he's guilty of any offence. We don't know yet. It's never happened before, and it's in a way unimaginable. Mm. When you think of the quite boring, if we're being honest, royal family doing about their duties very well, and everybody's cheered up if they come to open the hospital or your school or whatever it may be, this throws an absolute bomb into the whole idea of the monarchy.
Graham Smith is head of the anti-monarchy group Republic, which reported Andrew to police. He's told Times Radio that Andrew's arrest threatens the monarchy as a whole.
It opens up all sorts of questions about who knew what when, but, I mean, just the very fact that a senior royal has been arrested will fundamentally change the way people perceive the royals and blows open this idea that they're somehow untouchable, that they're kind of other and different to the rest of us.
Andrew's always denied any wrongdoing. In other news, the Times understands the UK is yet to give permission for the US to use the military base on Diego Garcia and RAF Fairford in Gloucestershire in the event that Donald Trump orders a strike on Iran. Trump said last night he wants the UK to scrap the Chagos deal with Mauritius. A man's been arrested after a woman was found dead in a freezer in Wales. Officers were called to a property in Porthcawl on Tuesday afternoon, where they discovered the body of an 80-year-old woman. A 60-year-old man's being held on suspicion of preventing a lawful burial. And a lobbying firm founded by Lord Mandelson has gone into administration. Staff at Global Council have been told it's no longer a going concern. Clients removed their business following revelations in the Epstein files. Mandelson denies all wrongdoing. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker. Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
Well, hello and good afternoon. It's Seb Payne sitting in for John Pienaar. John is taking a well-earned evening off, so I'm with you for the next 3 hours. It's a true delight to be back in the presenter's chair. Now, you may have heard me before on Hugo Rifkin and sitting in on the evening show, but I've always loved being one of John's regular friends since the very earliest days of Times Radio. It's not often that we are breaking news for the first time in 379 years, But that is exactly what happened today with the arrest of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor this morning. Police involvement with members of the royal family is very rare. It's likely that today's arrest is the first royal to be handcuffed since Charles I, way back in 1647. That is how unique this moment is for our politics, for our constitution, but above all, for our monarchy. There is much that has to be left to the police and due process at this very moment, but the immediate implications are significant, as is the long tale of how Mr. Mountbatten Windsor reached this remarkable moment. And that is not the only momentous story today. Keir Starmer has ploughed significant amounts of political capital into the deal to hand over the Chagos Islands to Mauritius. Yet, with just one long post on Truth Social, Donald Trump has pulled the rug from underneath him, asking, nay, telling the Prime Minister to bin the deal. It will put the transatlantic relationship to the test once again, but also the energy the Prime Minister has put into making this deal happen. Throughout the show, I'd love to hear your thoughts on these two big stories and more. Get in touch with us on 87222. Start your message with the word Times. This is Times Radio Drive with Seb Payne. But first, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor has been arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office. The arrest took place at 8 a.m. this morning at the King Sandringham Estate in Norfolk, where Andrew has been staying. It comes on the former prince's 66th birthday. The King released a statement in response to the arrest. It's been voiced by one of our production staff.
I have learned with the deepest concern the news about Andrew Mountbatten Windsor and suspicion of misconduct in public office. What now follows is the full, fair and proper process by which this issue is investigated in the proper manner and by the proper authorities. In this, as I've said before, they have our full and wholehearted support and cooperation. Let me state this clearly. The law must take its course. As this process continues, it would not be right for me to comment further on this matter. Meanwhile, my family and I will continue in our duty and service to you all. Charles.
And I do have to reassure you, that was not the King in the Times Radio studio. But here's what Keir Starmer said to BBC earlier, prior to the arrest.
One of the core principles in our system is that everybody is equal under the law and nobody is above the law. And it is really important that that is applied across the board.
Andrew Mountbatten Windsor denies all wrongdoing. From Sandringham, I'm now joined by Times Newsroom reporter Ollie Cole. Ollie, can you give us the latest?
Yeah, well, we've just seen, Seb, a couple of unmarked cars head into Andrew Mountbatten Windsor's, where he lives here on the Sandringham Estate in Wood Farm. There's been sort of dribs and drabs of those all day. The first ones this morning in a sort of grey, pretty cold, pretty rainy Norfolk at about 8 a.m. There was a flurry of unmarked vehicles heading onto Wood Farm. The morning, of course, of Andrew's 66th birthday. And there they were captured by a photographer. Obviously, there was a lot of interest in what was happening so early in the morning.